Tonight I thought I would say some things about fear, and it's such a huge subject, and to use the word fear is actually kind of dangerous, because there's so many varied concepts that fit under that rubric, under that name, and some of these things that fit under that name maybe are actually distinct things in their own right. Some people distinguish between fright and anxiety, for example, or fear and anxiety. And maybe they're two different animals. But anyway, it's a huge subject, but it's also a very important subject because fear is so incredibly pervasive. I think certainly in our culture, maybe in human beings in general. And perhaps to get a sense of how pervasive it is among everyone makes us a little bit less embarrassed or afraid to acknowledge our own fear. Because it's really, you know, it saturates our culture and everyone. And today is a good day, perhaps, to talk about fear because it's tax day. And I think that I suspect that a good percentage of the people who fill out tax forms, fear comes into play, some way or other. You know, that also makes me think that much of culture, traditionally and maybe still to this day, is controlled through the uses of fear. And how many people have, remember when they were school kids and the teacher used fear to kind of keep you in line? And corporations use fear to hold their employees in line, and governments use fear, and politicians use fear for all kinds of purposes, and advertisers use fear. And we're just suckers for fear. Otherwise, it wouldn't be so be used so much by on us, motivating it, stimulating it. End of last year, I requested a you know Dharma Seed Tape Library. Dharma Seed Tape Library is the this company in Massachusetts. Which makes available the Dharma tapes from Vipassana teachers in America. And they have a big business, and they sell, you know, tens of thousands of tapes all over America every year on Dharma, on Vipassana. And as many teachers who have their listings there and many different topics. So I asked them if they would send me their list of their top 10 tapes. I was curious what people are buying. Because it was part of my project to kind of try to, I wrote an article on the Vipassana movement in America, and so it was part of my research to try to get a sense of what really interests Vipassana students, and I thought that was kind of one little window in. And so the top 10. So the number one top 10, you like to know, you can all rush out and buy it now, is Sharon Salzberg tape on intensive metta practice. So that's nice. Four of the top 10 were about fear. Isn't that something? I thought four of the top 10 best-selling tapes in America had to do with fear. And then there were some others. I think one of them was Jack's famous talk on sexuality and Buddhism. Once upon a time, he gave a talk on sexuality 10 years ago or so, and that's still a bestseller. And then Jack had a talk on the sacred journey. But anyway, four of the top 10 were had to do with fear. And if people ask a meditation teacher about how to work with certain difficult emotions, the two most common emotions that people will ask about is anger and fear. And what's interesting is the attitude that we can have towards those two different emotions. If you give a talk on anger, as I have often done, and I have often then kind of received back from certain people, is, you know, wait a minute, what's wrong with a little bit of anger? And anger seems justified here or justified there, or it's motivating here, or, you know, you don't want to, you know. People can get very sensitive if you seem to imply that you're supposed to get rid of anger. So I'm being kind of simplistic. You give a talk on fear, and no one says, "Hey, wait a minute." wait a minute here. You know, fear is to be gotten rid of. You know, let's keep this hold of fear. Everybody wants to get rid of fear, but anger, you know, maybe the kind of mixed attitude towards it. But what's interesting about anger is that I mean, I don't know. I can't make a categorical statement, but it's certainly been my impression in my own life and in being a teacher and knowing other people's practice and the kind of different, some of the books I've read. Sylvia Borstein's husband is a psychiatrist, and he's written about this also, his opinion also, that underlying almost all forms of anger is fear. So what are we talking about then? And some people argue that fear and rage are closely related, that fear and rage are often kind of, I don't know what to say, but related responses to the same kind of threat, same kind of situation. So to understand fear is very important for anybody, I think, but certainly for Vipassana students, since it's such a prevalent part of everybody's life. And in Vipassana practice itself, we encounter fear both because we're fearful people, but also because Vipassana practice itself at times can bring up fear for people, can be frightening. Vipassana practice itself, the awareness practice of mindfulness, tends to set in motion certain changes within us, ourselves. And change is one of the sources of fear. And if you're holding on to a certain kind of identity for security reasons, and your awareness practice wants to kind of dissolve that sense of identity, then it can be very frightening. And I remember in my early years of practice, seeing very clearly the sense of self that I was holding on to, and the fiction of it, the particular fiction of that particular sense of self, and how I organized my life around that sense of self, and how what I really need to do is let go of it. And I saw the possibility of letting go of it, and I could see in some ways how wonderful it would be not to let go of it, and I was afraid. I was afraid to let go. And when people ask about how to work with fear in a mindfulness practice, often there's the idea that they're trying to get rid of it, that it's something that they're not supposed to have. So often, when there's an attitude of aversion or unacceptability that goes with having fear itself. And given that there's many different kinds of fear, still, the basic attitude people often have in practice is, let me figure out the key to get rid of the fear. And I don't think that mindfulness practice is really about getting rid of the fear. It has that byproduct to get rid of the fear, some fear. But I think fear, it's better to take fear and pain as just being normal parts of life. And that what we're learning in mindfulness practice is how to meet pain, how to meet fear, and how to make it workable in a sense, and not necessarily find this magic key that's going to get rid of it. Which I think, you know, is pretty unrealistic for most of us. But it's realistic to learn how to work with fear. This thing about, you know, the top four of the top 10 tunes had to do around fear. It makes me wonder sometimes, you know, what the motivation is for people to practice mindfulness in our culture. And I think sometimes there's a lot of people for whom mindfulness practice is simply a way to cope better with their life, their psychological life. And they're kind of adjusting kind of the psychological furniture in their mind, in their heart, to be able to cope a little bit better, to be a little better adapted to their culture, to not be so afraid when they go to work or whatever. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's a trap in it, in that, the potential trap, in that it's very easy to see a spiritual practice as being mostly a coping practice. It's helping you cope better with a situation, rather than really helping you go deep into maybe what we can call the spiritual roots of who we are. Um, And I've talked about this before, but I feel like kind of repeating it now. There are many kinds of fear, and one of the kinds of fear that can arise is the fear of doing, of wrongdoing. In Buddhism, this is considered to be actually a virtuous kind of mental quality or psychological quality, a certain kind of apprehension or fear for violating our own sense of personal integrity, which comes from breaking the precepts, for example, or hurting someone else from wrongdoing. And this kind of fear is considered to be appropriate fear. And as someone practices a spiritual practice and clarifies their heart, clarifies their mind, settles on their body, and feels comfortable in themselves, I think one of the consequences is people start having feeling more and more fear for violating that sense of comfort or integrity they have with themselves. And it's not so much an attitude of fear, going around being fearful, but it's rather an instant of fear, instant apprehension, when opportunity arises where you feel you're going to transgress something, transgress your own integrity. And there's also certainly fearful moments, you know, when the car comes barreling down the road at 60 miles an hour. What often happens is for many of us, there's a fearful attitude that comes into play, where the basic attitude we have for a certain period of the day or a certain period of our life or a certain lifetime is an attitude of fear. And it's a great surprise to some people, it was a surprise to me in my practice, to realize how at a certain level of my life, there was a fear was a huge, important, motivating factor. That for a long time in my life, fear was what was motivating many of my decisions, many of the ways in which I entered into situations, I entered into my relationship with other people, that fear was coloring it. And I've known people for whom it was a shock to realize that. And it's interesting that hope, which is very important for a lot of people, often arises out of fear. Some people actually point out that fear and hope are closely related. You don't have hope without fear. There's no need for hope without fear. So rather than living on hope, the Buddhist hope is that you clarify fear. When I was a freshman in college, I had to take English comp. And I had never written much in my life, and I wasn't particularly a good writer. But part of the quarter, one of the things you had to do in this particular class was you had to go to the office hours of this professor, and everybody had to go once to his office to talk to him one on one. And I think that's probably, looking back now, I think that's a really wonderful opportunity to have one on one discussion with the professor and talk about your work and what's going on with you. I was petrified. And it probably is the only time in my life I dissociated. But I walked into his office and sat down, and pretty soon the next thing I knew, I wasn't there. And I was kind of like two eyes in the wall. And I thought it was really weird that he was looking at the wall and talking to the wall. I felt completely, you know, calm and peaceful, and because it was easy because I wasn't there. And I don't, you know, I have no clue what happened in that office hours. All I knew at some point I was out in the hallway. But what I learned from that, which has served me very well ever since, is especially in terms of fear, is to be more certain about what I want in a situation. And whenever I would go back to professors later on to talk to them, I would always know what I wanted. And I'd kind of get some sense of what was reasonable to ask and why I wanted it and what my questions were. And so I'd come with some confidence, some certainty about what I was going to do. And what happened that first visit to the professor's office was I didn't have a clue why I was there or what I wanted or anything. So reflecting on what I want and what's reasonable and what is reasonable to want has helped me a lot in my life just with overcoming certain kind of the fear of uncertainty. So a sense of certainty often gives a sense of security, which can deflect or inactivate or just simply not trigger fear at all. But the desire for security itself can bring fear. And sometimes it's pointed out that the desire for security is one of the great sources of fear. And there's a wonderful quote by Krishnamurti. There is fear as long as you want to be secure. Secure in your marriage, secure in your job, in your position, in your responsibility, secure in your ideas, in your beliefs, secure in your relationships to the world or in your relationships to God. The moment the mind seeks security at any level, there is bound to be fear. Buddhism has this teaching about the eight winds. And the eight winds are, winds that kind of bat us about. And these are gain and loss, fame and obscurity, praise and blame, and happiness and unhappiness. Those are the six winds that we tend to get hooked by or caught by. These dualities between praise and blame, and failure and success, and happiness and unhappiness. And as long as we're concerned about those dualities, hooked on them, preoccupied with them, it's very easy for fear to have a toehold in our life, to grab us. And the suggestion, I think, the possibility that comes from practice is to see our tendencies to be concerned about fame, blame, success, failure, praise, happiness and unhappiness, to see that tendency and not necessarily buy into it. And if we haven't bought into it, then we don't. There's less reason to get afraid. And thinking about this, I remembered again visiting this wonderful Theravadan monk in San Diego County, named Tan Jeff is his name, and he's a forest monk. So he's gotten himself a forest monastery in San Diego County, which is an avocado orchard. And according to many criteria that many of us hold ourselves up to, he's a failure. He's completely a dull and uninteresting person. He's not, full of wit. He's not full of ready knowledge about popular culture. He's not full of knowledge about the latest political stuff. He's not, he's not bouncingly vivacious. He's not, I don't know, what is he not? He doesn't rush to speak. You're with him, and he's often quiet for some time. But even without all these things that many of us kind of measure ourselves with as being, what's necessary to be adequate socially, he doesn't have these things. But what he has is a wonderful sense of peace. And non-contentiousness, and it was palatable to be around him for me. Just delights. I didn't need to be around someone who was socially adept. It wasn't as interesting as to be around this person who was not so adept. Perhaps I don't know if maybe he was in his former life, but he didn't exhibit the kind of personality elements that many of us want, to think we want. Rather, he just had peace. He was at peace with himself. And I think many of us, the source of fear for a lot of people is, one of the more painful sources of fear is fear of being ourselves or fear of expressing ourselves. We're frightened that if we are who we are, express who we are, let other people know who we are, there's a fear of being rejected or fear of being seen as a failure, or fear of that people, all kinds of things. People institutionalize us if we really let off what's going on. The attitude that we have towards fear is an important area to investigate. And this attitude I described earlier of how everybody's happy about getting rid of fear. If I gave a talk about how to get rid of fear, no one would protest. But if I gave a talk about how to get rid of anger, I'm sure some of you would protest. So we have this attitude, you know, fear is unacceptable, I'm going to get rid of it. That attitude is maybe unnecessary. And the fear of fear, the aversion of fear, is part of the source of not only the power of fear, but part of the reason we get caught up in it and lost in it. And part of the investigation should be, what is our attitude towards the fear? What do we think about fear? What ideas do we have? What emotions do we have in relationship to it? Can we be comfortable with just with allowing fear to be there without anything else? And that, I think, is one of the crucial tasks of mindfulness practice, to recognize our fear, to allow it to be there, and then to face it head on, face on, straight on, honestly and kind of unwaveringly, not to try to make it better, not to try to get rid of it, and not to try to kind of get lost in it or accentuate it, not to deflect it, but simply to, this is my fear. I'm going to get to know this fear really well. I love the expression, you know, to be a connoisseur. You're going to be a connoisseur of something, connoisseur of fear. Because we can't expect to be free of fear, but we certainly expect ourselves to become really familiar with it. And the more familiar we become with it, the more quicker we'll be able to catch it as it becomes part of our life. And catching it earlier and earlier is one of the ways to find some ease and manage and workability with fear. I talked last week about how for some people it can be very useful to change how they talk about their emotional life, their fear, from talking about, you know, I am afraid, for example, to talking about there is fear here, or I have some fear. Because when we say I have fear, the tendency is for people, for many of us, is to believe that's who we are. We're a fearful person. We're full of, we are fear. That's what that little phrase really means, literally. I am afraid. I am afraid. But to say, you know, I have fear, or there's fear in this situation, indicates it's more to ourselves than just fear. And to see that fear is just a small element of who we are, part of who we are, and not all of us, can make it a lot easier to be present for fear. To listen to it carefully. And listening to fear, I think, is one of the things we need to do. Listening to what fear wants to express, what it's trying to say. What is the attitude, what is the intention that is behind the fear? One of the things that we explore in Buddhist practice is the intention that's part of any situation. What's the intention that comes into play with fear? In Buddhism, there's this meditation called the five skanda meditation. Meditation on the five, what's sometimes called the five heaps, or the five aggregates. And this is a classic Buddhist meditation that's used for helping us look at a particular event in our life from five different points of view. And the Buddha claimed, more or less, that there are only these five points of view that you can kind of... these five points of view cover everything, is what he said, cover all bases. And one is just to... So you can do that with fear, is you can try to look at it from these five different points of view. And the first is to look at it from the point of view of the body as physical sensation. To feel it in the body, to experience it in the body. I was afraid today, by the way. Probably many times today, some fear. The more sensitive you are, the more sensitive you are to subtle levels of apprehension and fear. And I don't remember exactly now what happened, but I was sitting in the bookstore at Stanford. I'd found a book, so I was sitting in a chair reading the book. And I was quite comfortable. And I don't know what made me a little bit apprehensive. Maybe the time, because I didn't have a watch. And so I was worried about coming down here in time, or I don't know what it was. But there was some apprehension arose. And I guess it was there for maybe a little bit, maybe a couple of minutes or something. And then I noticed it. And what I noticed was that my energy, my center of attention, my awareness in a sense, had gotten agitated and tight and risen up into my body, up to this kind of general area here, around my head, neck and my head. I almost disembodied in a sense. And I was no longer resting in my body. So it was interesting just to be aware, energetically and physically, how was I experiencing that fear? As soon as I could feel that, what I could feel also was that there was a lot of work to hold up against gravity that energy or that intention, those thoughts. And if I just paid attention to it and didn't add anything to it, the tendency of that apprehension was to settle and sink back to gravity, back into the body. And within a few seconds of noticing this, I was back into my body, and it was much more satisfying than to be breathing within my body, to have my center of attention and awareness in the torso, in the stomach, in the lungs, than up here in this kind of tight, convoluted place where the apprehension was. Some people experience fear in their shoulders. The shoulders go up when they're afraid. And when you have tension in your body in different places, you can certainly just be aware of tension and be mindful of it. But sometimes you can see, you know, what is there something, is there an emotion being expressed in this particular tension? And shoulders, you know, express a number of different emotions. I'm not going to say there's only one, but fear is a common one. I think that, you know, if someone says duck and you're afraid, you kind of go like that. So it's kind of built-in response of fear. But when we have this kind of psychological apprehension, anxiety in our life, the shoulders slowly go up. And I found in my own life that it's very useful not just simply to notice tight shoulders, but to notice what emotion seems to be part of it. And so if I can notice that there's fear there, it's almost as if it releases it by itself, just knowing it and seeing it clearly what it is. So seeing the fear from the physical point of view, from the body's point of view, is important. It's one of the five. The second is seeing the pleasantness and unpleasantness of the situation related to fear. Is it pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, the situation? The feeling tone, as it's called. And I guess I won't go into that because it could be a little bit complicated. But usually fear is an unpleasant situation. And when something is unpleasant, often an automatic reaction is aversion. We pull away or we strike out because we don't like it, because it's unpleasant. The third is our perceptions about it, which is our thoughts, a raw kind of basic thoughts and idea about it. Our fear about fear about the situation. What's our ideas? Well, we think that fear is unacceptable. We kind of take that as a given. Is it a given? We have to have that kind of attitude, basic association with fear. With different situations. So in the paper today, maybe some of you saw the study that someone made about places in America where it's you're most likely to die, something like that. And it said that, and a lot of people flee the inner urban cities for fear of the violence there, and for the suburbs. And you're much less likely to die of gunshot, you know, from being shot in the suburbs than you are in the urban areas in America. That they was pretty much a given. So if you're afraid of being shot, you're better off living in the suburbs. However, you're much more likely to die in an automobile accident in the suburbs than you are in urban areas. It's actually more dangerous to live in the urban area, in urban areas, because of the automobile danger. But in our minds, guns and gangs and inner cities and all that, and the danger looms so large that we have extra prisons and, you know, three strikes and you're out. I mean, all this whole politics of fear around crime in this culture, and the fear that people have of it, these locked communities and all. And maybe we need to be kind of concerned and take some, you know, protect ourselves somewhat. But no one seems to have the same kind of excited apprehension around being killed in an automobile accident. And you're more likely to die from a car accident than you are from gunshot. So the associations we have with different events and how that plays into our fears is one of the things we can investigate. Words. You know, the word cancer. You go into the doctor's office and he says, you have cancer. Talk about fear. It's, you know, I guess most doctors try not to say that word anymore, I think. Because, no? I think it's a little bit more sophisticated now than it used to be. But because it used to be, I think, that fear, the cancer was like, the C word came up and it was like a death certificate. And so all this fear arose. So the immediate associations with an event is a part of what we investigate. The fourth aggregate that we investigate is the intention, the motivation around something, the intention behind fear. What is the purpose of fear? What's being motivated by fear? I've seen it myself, fear of rejection. So fear. But what's motivating the fear of rejection? It's perhaps the desire to be loved. But what's motivating the desire to be loved? The fear of being alone. And, you know, and so it goes. And sometimes it can get kind of convoluted. But to ask, you know, what is the intention behind this? What is the motivation that's fueling this particular fear that we have? We go to work and there's apprehension. What is the intention that's motivating the fear that's happening at work? At work, are you being blown about by the eight winds? You know, if you're concerned about your reputation and you want to get, you know, what you're trying to do is get promoted up to the top levels of your corporation, and that has the most value for you. And the only way you can be an adequate, fulfilled human being is to, you know, get a certain kind of promotion. Your fear can be arise about things that threaten your promotion or threaten whatever. What is the motivation? What is it you need that you want that's causing the fear in you? And sometimes it's something which maybe if you look carefully at, you realize it's not worth it. It's not interesting. It's not important. And sometimes it is. Sometimes it has to do with our basic safety psychologically and physically. But even so, I mean, one of the things that mindfulness teaches us is that part of the power that mindfulness practice can have in our life is seen very clearly around fear, because mindfulness practice gives us something to do in situations that are frightening. People who if you go into the hospital for an operation, if it's a serious operation, that's for a lot of people a fearful event. And a lot of people don't have a clue what to do. You know, well, they take a sedative or they don't do anything, just sit there anxiously in the waiting room waiting for their turn to go in. Mindfulness practice gives us something to do in situations that are dangerous, that are threatening. We can sit there and be mindful of fear itself. We can explore it, we can breathe with it, we can investigate it in the body, we can investigate our feelings and our emotions with it. And investigation of it makes it workable. And just simply sensing that we can work with something, we have tools for working on it, can give us a tremendous sense of empowerment and power in situations that are often disempowering. For example, sometimes in a hospital. And I mentioned last week the study which I'd read, or this not study, but this doctor who had one of the first doctors or early doctors who did alternative treatments for cancer, kind of using the mind and positive thinking or something like that. And he said that when people came to his program and they figured out that what he was asking of them was to take some responsibility for their own healing by how they thought and how they used their minds and how they, their stress level and taking care of these things, half the group left. People don't want to kind of engage themselves in their life with things that they can do very simply. So realizing that there's something we can do in difficult situations is fundamental to finding some ease and perhaps even healing in a situation. And so mindfulness practice gives us that opportunity. And mindfulness practice is to look very carefully directly at fear, not to turn away from it. It's kind of maybe mindfulness practice sometimes is counterintuitive, because intuitively maybe what we want to do is run away from fear, run away from pain. Mindfulness practice, we go directly into it. Say, aha, there it is. It's my chance to get to know it. And then you hang out with it and you explore it, you get to know it. And eventually you feel comfortable with having fear, not embarrassed about having fear. I used to be a little bit embarrassed. I used to feel embarrassed about admitting that I had fear to this group here. I thought, you know, actually I'm a meditation teacher, you know, I shouldn't have fear. I better not say it, you know. Because it was kind of embarrassing. But anyway, I've mostly overcome that. So I get frightened for sure. Sometimes I get nervous to come down here to this group. How about that? The other thing to explore around fear is not only what's motivating it or what's the motivation or intention that might be fueling it, but also what we're afraid might happen. Sometimes anxiety, especially, belongs to a nebulous world of thoughts and imagination, and about the future often. And if you kind of, and sometimes it's nebulous, and because we don't look at it clearly, we kind of turn away from it so quickly, we don't really enter into and see clearly this world of thoughts and ideas that we're kind of lost and swimming in. But one of the ways to explore it is to reflect, what is it that we're afraid might happen in a situation? And you can ask that question again and again. It's very interesting to ask it. You can say, well, what are you afraid of? Well, I'm afraid of that, you know, I'm afraid if I don't show up in a three-piece business suit that I won't get that promotion. So what? What are you afraid will happen then? Well, if I don't get the promotion, then I'm afraid that at the next downsizing I'm going to lose my job. So what? What are you afraid of then? I'm afraid that I'll be out in the streets homeless. And what are you afraid of then? I'm afraid that I'll be all alone, no one will love me. And you keep asking that question. It's very interesting because at some point you get down to something which is very core and root in our personality, in our being. And you come down to that root issue. It's often, if you find that one thing, sometimes so much arises out of that. And if we can find that root thing, it's often kind of in our subconscious, and get familiar with it, you can see how it's operating all the time in our life. But it happens so quick that we don't see it so quickly. So you have to, you know, what are you afraid might happen? What if that happened? What then? What then? What then? And that question sometimes can be very revealing. So we hang out with fear in mindfulness practice. When fear arises, we hang out with it. And I'm repeating myself from recent weeks, but it's just hanging out with something in an open way, to bring awareness to something in an open way, that in itself is healing. And you don't necessarily have to figure out anything or analyze it or do any of these other exercises. Simply to hang out and not react, but hang out with mindfulness, with a mindful awareness to something, that in itself is healing. It kind of works the same way, miraculous way, as if you cut your finger with a knife. You can keep the wound, you know, clean and bandaged and whatever. And that's like putting awareness around yourself. You can't do the healing of that cut. That happens by itself. And as much of our own inner healing that has to happen happens on its own. But we create the conditions. And one of the powerful conditions is just holding it all in the warm embrace of mindfulness, of awareness. And holding it and holding it and holding it. And then you get impatient, and then you hold the impatience. And then the impatience goes away, and then you hold the fear again. So any comments or questions? I mean, this is such a huge topic, I feel like, you know, scratch the surface.
The fifth one, the fifth skanda?
Oh, I didn't say it. The fifth skanda is consciousness. And that's all. Next. Yes?
I've noticed that fear disguises itself.
In what?
I can't think right now, but I feel like it can take many different forms. I don't always recognize it.
Uh-huh. So what are some of the disguises of fear?
Anger.
Humor.
Humor.
Compulsive.
Uh-huh.
Sarcasm.
Uh-huh. Hmm?
Guilt.
Sadness?
The real issue could be fear, and it can just go with sadness.
And depression? A lot of depression arises out of fear, or sometimes out of anger, but yeah, it gets disguised, or something else, it kind of triggers something else which becomes bigger. And I told this story a little bit, but you know, I get angry when people up in Skyline at night, if people shine their headlights at me when they drive against me. And so after a while I noticed, you know, I kept getting angry. So what was going on there? It happened so fast. And so I started paying attention to what, and it usually happened so fast I just was aware of anger. But then at some point some months ago I finally saw that just before the anger there was fear. And now it's a whole new game. But has it helped you to see that?
I can't always I'm not always sure if it's fear. I mean, I guess I just have to just keep watching and watching.
Mm-hmm.
Because I realize it's very tricky. It doesn't want to be seen.
I just had a comment. I find that sometimes when I'm trying to be spacious around something, it feels as if my mindfulness waxes and wanes a bit, and it's difficult to stay with. So what I've begun doing is following my breath as almost a grounding or centering, and then going back to the fear.
Uh-huh.
And as she's talking about the different layers that come up, it's almost like coming up for air and then going back down. It seems to help.
Beautiful. So it's not necessary to just hang out with difficulties. You hang out with it for a while until either it's too difficult or you feel like you've been there long enough for some reason. And sometimes then it's useful to back off and just do a little bit more kind of basic, general, either mindfulness or just follow the breath or do some loving kindness to help quiet and stabilize the mind and the body. The more stable, the quieter the body and the mind are, the more powerful the lens of investigation is. And so sometimes if you've investigated a certain level of consciousness, a certain level of certain level of mind-body speed, sometimes it's nice just to back off and get quieter or calmer and then look at it again from a quieter point of view. Jonathan?
Do you choose to do these things when you're doing a meditation? I mean, they don't come up during my meditation. There are these problems in my life that happen. But when I'm in my meditation, my mind wanders, or I concentrate on my breathing. But all the important things, they don't rise up and say, now you should think about me for a while and explore this problem of your fear of this situation.
Yeah, generally,
can
I
you choose that?
You can. Generally, but this is just a general rule, I would discourage you from doing something like that in your meditation. Rather, let your meditation be what it is and sit as best you can. And in that context, whatever is going to come up, let that come by itself. And if it's not none of your big problems from daily life, don't worry about it. But then you can do what I've been talking about the last weeks, is as you leave your meditation session, pay careful attention to how you reconstruct your personality and your life and your reality. Because if you get very calm in meditation or somewhat quiet, a lot of the usual thought structures we have are quieted down. But as you come out of meditation, you kind of those come back into play. And there's an opportunity there to see it in a clearer way than you usually can if you're caught in the middle of your life. So rather than bringing them into your meditation, bring that awareness of meditation into your daily life in a more careful way. So maybe Elaine can have the last one, because it's late now, and Lelaine, after all, she's responsible.
I've come to the conclusion that the only time I ever grow is a result of fear. And although the suggestion that you just made just right now about paying attention as you start to reconstruct yourself after meditation would certainly be an easier way to grow, I've got to admit that when things are going well, I don't do anything that
well, a couple of things. One is, it's best just to leave your meditation to follow its own process. Don't bring your agendas into it. You know, don't bring fear along, you know, so you can grow. And what it means to grow is different things. And the deeper levels of spiritual growth, some aspects of them, happen in the context of a tremendous amount of happiness and well-being. Happiness and well-being? So may you all become friends with your fear.